Let's turn to your footsteps of Messiah to finish this off a little bit. Night happened when the original fall of Satan happened, and the original earth was cursed with darkness and water. And then God actually kept night and day going as a reminder of that. And so when you see in Genesis recreation of planet Earth for Adam and Eve, there were the time of darkness and then the time of light. And notice the order in Genesis. It's night first, then day. Night first, then day. That's the Jewish reckoning of time. Okay, why metaphorically or spiritually speaking does night come before day? So again, if night or darkness represents judgment, and day represents what? So it represents redemption, it represents salvation. Jesus is called the morning star because it represents a new day. When he, whatever the Lord brings, he brings light. Light represents revelation, right? Darkness means no revelation. So when you get the metaphors all down, that those themes are carried out through the Bible. That's why when you go into the Gospel of John, they'll deal with the themes of light and darkness. Those are metaphorical themes for those kinds of things. But it's real. So when you're dealing with darkness, it means a lack of revelation. It means judgment. It means cursing. Okay? So what is the kingdom of Satan called? The kingdom of what? Darkness. It doesn't have revelation there. It's a kingdom that's cursed. It's a kingdom that will be judged one day. Okay. So then why orchestrate our days in such manner? Why have a night? What is it telling us? What is God trying to show us through darkness and then light? Darkness and then light. In order to get to light, which is the morning, you got to do what? You have to get through the night, if that makes sense. And so the way your life and my life is orchestrated in this world is we got to go through the darkness of this world in order to get to the new day, in order to get to that new life that Christ promises for those who believe in him. This is why this place that C.S. Lewis wrote his book called The Shadowlands. You ever heard that book, The Shadowlands? He termed it because that's what you're in. You're in the Shadowlands. There's a famous passage in Scripture that talks about being in the shadows. Do you recall it? Yeah, it's the 23rd Psalm, the Valley of the Shadow of Death. Okay, it refers to death as darkness and whatnot. If you go back to where these paths were coming from the Dead Sea into Jerusalem, they're very tricky. And if you travel on there by night, you could die. Okay? Because the ledges are right off the side. There's no handrail. There's nothing. And so that valley of the shadow of death, obviously death represents darkness and things of that nature, talks about us walking that path. But what does it say is with me, though, on that path? The Lord is with me, right? It's that simple, but you see the metaphor. And then you other passages, his word is a what to our feet? A light or a lamp. So the idea is that when you're walking in this world, you're walking in a very dark world, and the only way you're going to get through the valley of death or the shadow of death or the darkness is by his revelation of how to get through it, the word. Okay? And if you follow that word, it leads you to morning through the night. So it's the idea of a picture of you and I walking at night with a lamp in our hand to get to the other place. That's a picture of your walk right now. And so the way the 24-hour day is framed is to remind you of that. Darkness, then light. And so we're now going through the darkness to get to the light. And the only way you're going to get there is through the revelation. That's the image that God wanted to, for everyone to hear. Now, once you're there, obviously that's why there's no darkness. There's no shadow. There's no night. There's no death. Because you've made it. You made it to the morning. You made it to where there's a place where there is no shadow or darkness anymore. So the metaphor, you don't want to take that and just read that and say, yep, okay, no sun or moon or whatever, no, because the light comes from God, okay. It is a big theme throughout the entire Bible. This is what we've been waiting for, to get to a place where there's no sin, there's no death, there's no evil in the world, and we don't have to worry anymore about falling off the path. We've made it home, basically. We're now in the eternal morning, the new day. Question, what day was Jesus resurrected on? Sunday. What day is that? As far as the Hebrew calendars, it's the eighth day. I know it's the first day of the week, Sunday, but it's also considered the eighth day. The number eight in Hebrew represents new creation. So he was resurrected on not only the third day, the first day, but the eighth day. And anytime you see the number eight, it represents a new beginning. So the Feast of Tabernacles is a feast day of 7 days. It's the last feast day of the Hebrew calendar year. But they have an unspoken celebration at the end of the feast. So the Feast of Tabernacles is a feast of refers back to history when the Israelites lived in tabernacles, and then it refers to the future of when, you know, God's going to tabernacle again with his people and have all the nations there. And so it's a all nations festival for the millennial kingdom. It's a millennial feast. But after the millennial feast is over, the Feast of Tabernacles, on the eighth day, you went home. And that eighth day actually became a celebrated day for when you go home. It was the eighth day, and then it got turned into a metaphor of after the millennial kingdom, we go into eternity, the final eighth day, the new beginning, the eternal morning. And so even in the Feast of Tabernacles, that eighth day, that new morning is celebrated among the Jews. Now, whether or not they know all the facets of it, I don't know. But when we look at it from a Christian standpoint, you look back at it, it totally makes sense. After the Messianic kingdom, we go into eternity. The New Jerusalem is eternity. We get to experience eternity even during the Messianic age. But eventually, everyone experiences this final day where there's no shadow, no darkness or whatnot. I don't know. Any questions so far on that? That kind of makes sense. And then it says in 5b, and they shall reign forever and ever. And the idea of they shall reign is referring to those, the bride of Christ, in the passage in Revelation 21, refers to him seeing the bride of the Messiah. And the idea here is, we had once the capacity through Adam and Eve to rule and reign. That was the intention of how God set things up in the original Garden of Eden. But obviously, man lost the capacity to rule and reign. He lost his dominion, and he was usurped by a usurper, Satan, who now becomes the god of this world. Well, through Jesus' death on the cross, he regained our ability to rule and reign this planet once again. And that's the whole point of Revelation chapter 5. It's him getting Jesus through his death, got us the title deed back, basically. And the scroll is not only the title deed, but it's the way to expunge evil out of this world before we rule and reign with him. And so this idea of ruling and reigning then comes back to the original concept of what Genesis taught, that that's what we should have been doing this whole time. So then let's go further with that. Now we see that passage, but then you have to bring in other passages about ruling and reigning. And what we find out is not all believers will rule and reign. There will be some that don't and some that will. And the main thing about ruling and reigning is faithfulness and overcoming the certain situations that you see in Revelation 2 through 3. So the believer has to overcome those things to rule and reign. He has to be faithful for his life to be able to rule and reign. So that's a privilege that is what we call an active reward, not a passive reward. Active rewards mean you earn those things. Passive rewards mean everyone's given the reward. And ruling and reigning is an active reward. Okay, so let's go further with this. What New Jerusalem is doing is setting up how the eternal structure will work, how you will fit into that eternal structure, and what that means for the rest of eternity. And a lot of people don't think through this because sometimes their mind goes on tilt in thinking about eternity, but you are setting your destiny up right now for all eternity. You're setting it up. You are responsible for your life right now, as you know, but how you will be rewarded is how responsible you were with the kingdom things in mind. So, what does this mean? Let me go a little deeper. In order to be rewarded properly with ruling and reigning, your values must be the same now as the values there in that new world. You must not value the things of this world, but you must value the things of that world in order to be rewarded properly. If you stay stuck on valuing the things of this world ends in flames, is what Peter talked about. So whatever you value in this world is useless to you. It'll be, you are not taking it with you, so to speak. So the way you live to prepare for eternity, obviously, is to accept, first of all, the values of that place. What does that mean, to accept the values? It means I store up treasure in heaven. I do things that matter for eternity, and I don't waste my time doing stuff and spinning my wheels on the things of this world. Now, it doesn't mean I don't focus on working and making a living and providing. It doesn't mean that, because you'll be no earthly good. But it does mean that the way I structure my life is geared for that next life. Okay, well, what does that mean? Go even further than that. In order to act properly, in order to behave properly, your values must be able to be matched up. So if you notice at yourself that you're not living for that eternal life in such a way, it has to do with what you value. So if you want to check, if you ever ask yourself, why do I behave the way? Why am I so worldly? Why am I so stuck on this world? Why am I so focused in on it? Then you have to go back to what you value. And your values will tell you why you're behaving the way you do. So the two are interlinked. And I'm telling you what, what is the hallmark of the Laodicean church? They're useless to the Messiah. And do you know why the Laodiceans are useless? Because they're too worldly. They're absolutely too worldly. The problem with the Laodicean church was they were very rich. One of the richest churches ever, especially in Asia Minor, because they made a black wool that they sold for a lot of money. And they had an eye salve that they sold for a lot of money. So the people that went to that church were extremely wealthy and prosperous. And what happened is they became useless because they got focused too much on this world instead of eternity. And that's why Jesus said, I want to vomit you out of my mouth, because they valued the wrong things. And we're watching that right in front of our very eyes in the church. So many Christians have become worldly. They're no good for the kingdom, and they won't be able to rule and reign because of that, because they're too busy building their kingdoms here. In verse 6, page 535, you can follow me there if you want, or follow me in your Bibles. In verse 6, it says this, then he said to me, these words are faithful and true. And the idea there is that everything John is reporting is, you know, a guarantee. It's valid. Now, you'll see this in really only in the book of Revelation, and there's a reason why I believe you'll see these types of words. It's because the book of Revelation was accepted early on by most of the church fathers. There's no doubt about that, early on. But then you started having these liberal church fathers come in, they started rejecting the book of Revelation. And then by the time you get to Augustine, he doesn't like it. And so he allegorizes the whole thing. Luther couldn't stand the book. Calvin did no commentary on the book because he didn't like it. And Zwingli, both Zwingli and Luther did not want to put the book of Revelation into the canon. That's how much opposition the book of Revelation had. And I think God anticipated that when he puts all these warnings and these blessings in there and saying, what I'm telling you is true, because most of Christendom through the last 2,000 years has really not ever read it, understood it, abided by it, or even accepted it as canon. And so that's why you'll see these things constantly affirming the book of Revelation. And then it says, and the Lord God of the holy prophets sent his angel to show his servants the things, and this is where I want to capitalize on, which must shortly take place. Your Greek word for that is entakos, E-N, and then T-A-C-H-O-S, in tacos, is where we get the word tachometer. And the idea here is, people read the English and say, well, that things are predicted here, it's going to shortly take place after John writes it. Well, no, that's not what it's saying, because we've had 2,000 years. And it didn't happen right after John said that. What that means in the Greek is that once it begins, it happens rapidly. That's what the Greek entakos means. And then in verse 7, and then it says, behold, I come quickly. It's the same word, but in a different way. It's taku, T-A-K-H-U, taku, I come taku. Again, it's using the word entakos, the idea of tachometer. And then it says, the way to translate this, when I come, it will happen quickly. When these events start happening, it will happen quickly, and then I come quickly. Okay, so what you're seeing, you should already get a glimpse of tachos right now. The acceleration of things should be blowing your mind, because that's what is blowing my mind. Everybody I talk to, whether it's Howler, Brandon House, Sharam Hadium, all those guys are freaking out about how quick it's happening. That's what's taking us all aback. Of like, it's boom, 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 like that. And what we're starting to see is what Messiah said is be like birth pangs. That as the birth gets ready to happen, you have the intensity, and then you have the frequency of things happening quicker and quicker before the baby is born. And that's how Messiah said it would be in the last days. You would see the frequency and the intensity ramp up. And then you marry this with this word, entakos. And it has the idea that once it begins, it goes faster than what you think. So when I talk about like this reset that they're talking about, and think about where we were at in January to where you're at now. I want you to think about that. In 6 months, we've leaped over major chasms to now, hey, a digital currency, digital tracking system is right on the table for everybody. They're wanting to do this, wanting to a new economy, this and that, globalism, yada, 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 and the whole thing. Well, you're experiencing entakos. You're experiencing the frequency speeding up. So at the end of the day, the generation that lives closest to all these things happening understands the scriptures the best. And so the idea here is you and I are living in the last days. And it doesn't take a lot of faith to see the rapidity of things. Back 2,000 years ago, they didn't know how this was going to happen. But now you and I do. And so the way I would say it is, you and I are a very blessed generation to see this. Many Christians long to see how this would unfold. And you and I are watching that. So yes, things are getting bad, but at the end of the day, God is faithful in his word. When he says entakos, that's what he meant. Exactly what you're seeing. Now, look at the other blessing that comes from this, and this is where I want to then do our application. Blessed is he who keeps the words of the prophecy of this book. Now, again, that's what I'm talking about. The book of Revelation is the only one that throws out those promises and blessings to those who keep the words of this book. Okay, the idea of keep the words is not just simply complies and obeys. It's those who guard and protect the book of Revelation. Why? What does that mean? Why would people, believers, get a special blessing for protecting the book of Revelation and the prophecies thereof? Why? What's so different about that versus James or 1st and 2nd Thessalonians or whatever, 1st Corinthians. Why are we told to guard the prophecies in the book of Revelation? Much of the church wants to eliminate it. So I think what you're starting to realize, especially in the days we're living in, this book is not taught. This book is not explained from pulpits. So therefore, when you talk to these Christian people on social medias and whatnot, and they're clueless about what's happening, they can't connect dots, they don't see all the things that are lining up, it's because their pastors and their churches and they themselves have not guarded this book. You, going forward, will have to guard and protect the book of Revelation. How will you protect the book of Revelation? Put it in a lock and key? Put it in your thing? What does that mean? How would you protect the book of Revelation from other, from like Matthew? And it's, no other book is told to be protected. Why? How would you do that? Yeah, you have to know it. You what? You have to. To protect the book, you have to speak about it. You have to tell the truth about what's in there. You have to be a watchman on the wall and tell people regardless if they don't want to hear it. You are protecting the prophecies by explaining them. When you don't explain them to your friends, family, whatever, you are not protecting the book of Revelation. Just like they're not. The sin of silence doesn't protect. That's what these churches are doing. That's what these pastors are doing. They're committing the sin of silence by not teaching the book of Revelation. Therefore, they're not protecting it. It's those pastors that keep the book of Revelation on the forefront. Not like we teach it every day, but it's protected. We guard it. This is what's going to happen. And we tell people that. We keep it on the front burner is what your job is. And so your job as a watchman on the wall is to promote the book of Revelation. That's why there's all these blessings attached to knowing and studying and understanding the book of Revelation. That's why it's the only book in the Bible that gives a blessing for knowing and understanding it. It causes evangelism. That's right. Yeah. It also causes for you to get your morality straightened up. That's another thing that prophecy does for people. It's urgency for evangelism, urgency for cleaning up your own act, and then which we have those things in balance and you understand that in your walk with the Lord, then you're more effective. So knowing and studying the book of Revelation makes you actually a more effective Christian because it's going to say, yes, it's going to get bad, but there's a glorious future coming. The Messianic Kingdom and eternity and the New Jerusalem, what we're studying. There's all these things that God has promised to us. And so you want to avoid this by being raptured, by believing in the Messiah. So there's where your evangelism comes in. And so what's happened is the churches have no effectiveness using prophecy because they don't know the book of Revelation. They're not protecting it. And you can see the cataclysmic fall of the church for simply not knowing basic stuff. I'll tell you what, I would put you guys against most of the pastors here in town if you were to do a debate with the book of Revelation with them. Most of them know zero. Zero. You know, you're shocked, I know. But no, no joke, man. Zero knowledge. How can you be a pastor and have zero knowledge of the book of Revelation? That's scary, isn't it? They have bought into the lie that it's not needed. Prophecy scares people. It's doomsday. And so they bought into maybe the seeker-friendly Rick Warren model of, you know, let's not scare people. Let's make everyone happy and not tell them the reality of the way the world's going. And so it works to build a crowd to not teach prophecy. Prophecy thins it out. Guaranteed. Prophecy will thin it out. When you give steak to a baby, what does a baby do with that steak? It can't digest the meat because it's on milk. So when you're talking to other believers and you're throwing out those steaks of prophecy that's taken you a long time to figure out, they definitely can't digest it. It's going to go right over their head and you're like, I don't understand why you don't understand me. It's because it's steak and they're on milk. They've been in churches on milk for 30 years. No one's been teaching them that. Let's end with this. Your job then, it says, blessed is he who keeps the words of this or guards the prophecy of this book. Okay, so we know what it means to guard the prophecy. But what is this blessed state that you're going to be in? He's promising a blessing to you. Blessed is he. Blessed is he. Now, I think you know what blessed means. But in this context, it's trying to tell you something. It's giving you a reward right here and now for protecting the book of Revelation. And what is the reward? Because I can tell you this, you're going to be called all kinds of names for protecting the book of Revelation, okay? I get called all kinds of names. I you know, you're going to get it. You're going to be persecuted to some degree by calling your, you know, a tinfoil hat brigade or whatever. This is the new one, how they try to shut you down. You're just too political. It's classic. When they say that, it means they don't know prophecy. Because prophecy intersects with politics constantly. They're just saying, you're too political, you're a nut job, you're a lunatic, you know, whatever. The blessing then has to do with counteracting the persecution you get for protecting the book of Revelation. What do you mean? Blessing means that you will have an inner contentment in what you're doing. It doesn't mean you're happy. It means inner contentment in knowing that you're doing the will of God and no one can take you out of that will. Because you're guarding it, you're doing exactly what you need to do, and you walk away from these situations with an inner contentment, knowing I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. That is the blessing that you receive by protecting. Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. Inner contentment takes away fear. They won't be able to make you afraid. They won't be able to shut you down. They won't be able to scare you. Shut your mouth. Don't say that. Because you'll have this inner contentment, which is a blessing, and that will actually give you the strength to keep doing it. So it makes you like a rock when you know it. No one can move you. They can't tell you anything different. And that's the blessing you get.